Sorry, someone is mowing the lawn outside. For f- sake.
I was like, oh no, Micah's being abducted.
That would be 2020.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Election Day is exactly 2 weeks from today, and we are in daily podcast mode, so let's dive into it. Over the past several months, you've heard us talk plenty about likely tipping point states, or the states that are likeliest to give the winning presidential candidate his 270th Electoral College vote. Those are states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, and Michigan. But while those races may be the most important in terms of electoral math, they're not actually the closest races according to current polling and our forecast. The states showing a dead heat in the presidential contest are actually states like Ohio, Georgia, Iowa, and even Texas. So today we're going to focus on the most competitive races, both in the contest for the presidency and also the House and Senate, and also what those contests tell us about our current political environment. So here with me to do that, our managing editor, Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hey, Galen. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Micah.
Also here with us, as you mentioned, is politics editor Sarah Frostenson. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Galen.
So before I dive into the meat of the questions that I have for you, managing editor, politics editor, you're like steering the ship and its destination is 2 weeks away. How are you all feeling? How are you thinking about how the newsroom is handling this?
Let me answer that question with another question. Sarah, how much do you feel like you're steering the ship versus like clinging on, screaming for help?
I know, right? No, I think one of our more entertaining exercises, we're trying to map out all the different possible scenarios because there's just so much up in the air this year in terms of the margin. Will we know on election night? What if we don't know for 2 weeks from now? What do we have in terms of legal experts on staff? So no, I don't feel like I'm steering it, Micah.
Having been politics editor at 538 during a crazy election, not as crazy as this one, I can say that in the last few weeks, you're just clinging on for dear life. Things get so hectic and so nonstop that it's really hard to keep big picture in mind, which Sarah has somehow managed to do despite an even crazier election than 2016, so...
That's too kind. I mean, I think one hurdle for sure is just the fact that we're all remote. I know that's a new reality that we've all embraced at this point, but I think one thing for election night is we're all expect being in the office, we're watching the results come in together, and that'll be just trying to coordinate us and every other newsroom. That'll be a challenge.
I don't want to get too meta here, but I mean, let's go for it for a second at least. What does success look like to you all? Like, this is a job interview. What does success mean in this role?
It's a good question. I think for the election in particular, I try to look for, are we uncovering, explaining, exploring the issues and themes and factors that are most influential in the election? So Sarah, as politics editor, has done this amazingly, actually. Are we exploring and uncovering why is Trump underperforming this year relative to where he was in 2016? Well, we just had a great piece on the site looking at how demographic groups have changed relative to 4 years ago. What do people care about? Are we looking into those issues and exploring how much those are driving the campaign? So that's, I think, the metric for success. You know, in 2016, one thing I was really proud of was like, we had a lot of coverage in the lead up to the election on Trump's Electoral College advantage and how there might be an Electoral College popular vote split. So it's like that kind of thing, right? It's like, are you shining a spotlight on the things that end up being important in hindsight?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I would just add to that, that the other goal I have for this year is that voters and readers are able to understand what's happening night of, like what we do know and what we don't know, and us being as transparent as possible as results are coming in and like, this looks right, here's why this might be a bit funky, and making sure we're doing the prep beforehand for that, because there's just so much we don't know this year.
All right. Well, it will be a very exciting night. And of course, we will all be covering it until we have the very last results. So there's something to look forward to, listeners. But let's get to the crux of the matter today, which is the most competitive races that we're seeing across the board in 2020. So let's start here. I mentioned those four states at the top. In the 2012 election, President Obama won Iowa by 6 percentage points, Ohio by 3 percentage points, and then lost Georgia by 8 and lost Texas by 16. In 2016, Trump won Iowa by 9 points, Ohio by 6 points, Georgia by 5 points, and Texas by 9 points. So he won all of those four states. Back in 2012, it was split with Obama winning the upper Midwestern states and Romney winning the southern states. Now we're in a situation where these are all polling at roughly even. Our forecast gives different odds depending on the state. Like, it's less likely that Joe Biden will win Texas, for example, than Georgia. But the actual polls, you look, these are all about like a 1 point race. So what has happened in American politics that have put all four of these states in roughly the same place in 2020?
So, at least according to the polling, Biden is up by a lot overall. These are all Republican-leaning states. And the fact that the polls in each of them show a close race is a testament to Biden's big lead overall, right? That's the main factor. Two, remember all those debates about should Democrats appeal to the Obama-Trump voters, white working-class voters, right? Or should they double down on their newfound strength among college-educated whites in the suburbs? Or should they try to turn out non-white voters? The data shows, and Nate Cohn over at the New York Times had a good piece about this, but, you know, Biden has improved on Clinton's margins with white non-college-educated voters. He's also improved upon her margins in diverse suburbs like you see in Georgia and Texas. And Trump has doing a little better among Black voters, particularly Black men, a little better among Hispanic voters. We'll see how real that is. But like you've seen in all these states being competitive, it's testament to me that when you see movement in American politics, it tends to happen across demographic groups. Politics is rarely sort of a binary, mutually exclusive choice. Should I appeal to this group or this group, right?
I think that's a really good point. And something I was thinking about too is you see, as Micah said, Biden improving with white voters, particularly those without a college degree, where Clinton was in 16, right? But at the same time, he's also making huge strides in these Sunbelt states, right? So it is that combination. It's not one or the other. And some of that, I think, just speaks to the fact that he's got a double-digit lead nationally over Trump. And so the generic ballot, which looks at congressional races to try to suss out, well, which way is the electoral environment leaning, is right now 7.4 points in favor of Democrats, which is like another blue wave, like election territory. I mean, we still have, you know, a week and a half here to go. And so like that can tighten. But a piece we did earlier in the week where we were looking at, well, how much do the polls move in the last 2 weeks of the campaign? On average, they don't move that much. Again, there could be further tightening. But at this point, it does seem as if we're moving into that realignment territory in the way that we did in 16 in some ways. It doesn't mean, though, Texas will be blue in every election moving forward. But it does seem as if there's some really big shifts at play where we're talking about, to your point, Galen, Texas, Iowa, Georgia, Ohio, as the states where the margin is like plus or minus 5, and not Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, where Biden actually has a 6-point lead if you look at the projected vote share. And even though Pennsylvania will still most likely be the tipping point state, according to our forecast, that to me is fascinating that the projected margin there is large enough that those aren't really the states we're talking about as the most competitive here in 2020.
Mary, who works on our polling database, she gave us a spreadsheet of all the projected vote share margins according to the forecast for in every state for the presidential race and every Senate race and every House race. And if you round to the nearest whole number in the presidential race, Georgia, Ohio, and the second district in Maine all round to a projected margin of 0. Texas rounds to a projected margin of Trump plus 3, Iowa, Trump plus 1. North Carolina, Biden plus 2, Florida, Biden plus 3. So it's like, to say these are close races, they are really, really close races. It's pretty amazing.
And The reality is, if my math is correct, the Democrats don't have to win any of those races in order to win the presidency.
Yeah, they don't. And, you know, our snake chart on our forecast does this. If you arrange all the states by, let's use Biden's projected margin from biggest to smallest, he crosses 270 votes with Pennsylvania. After that comes Nebraska's second district, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Maine's second district, Ohio, Georgia, Iowa, Texas. So all these states are gravy for Biden if he wins them in terms of the Electoral College. Of course, there are important Senate races, House races, down ballot races in these states. So how well Biden does in them will matter regardless. And also, I would argue that the size of Biden's victory, if he wins, could have important ramifications in terms of, okay, what kind of mandate does he have? How much of a check have the American people given Democrats to enact their policies?
All right. So as we've mentioned, these states are not necessary for Biden to win the election, while they are necessary for President Trump. How much attention are the campaigns giving these states? Given that they're not the tipping points, are they still competing in them, giving them resources and so on?
They are competing in these states. And you've seen the Trump campaign spend a lot of money and, in fact, visit these states that, from their point of view, I'm sure they were hoping were sewn up by this point. Ohio, Iowa, states like that. There was a lot of debate in 2016, obviously, around campaign strategy and where the candidates visited. I think the Trump campaign is, at least judging by their behavior, they know they have some work to do in these red-leaning states.
I think a theme in some of these shifts is the suburbs, which sounds very trite because we talk about the suburbs in every presidential election and we're like, oh, it's going to be decided in the suburbs. And of course, yes, if urban areas are blue and rural areas are red, then yes, it all gets decided in the more purpley areas. But specific to Georgia and Texas, I think we are seeing a politics that is driven by these sprawling suburbs around places like Atlanta, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, etc. So how have our suburbs evolved politically over the past 4+ years?
So we've actually done two pieces recently that looked at this. Both use NationScape data, one in which the common thread seems to be that we are seeing the suburbs move to the left, but that's largely driven by white suburban women. White suburban men, on the other hand, tend to still vote for Trump. There's a pretty big gender gap. And also, Trump has made some gains with college-educated voters this year, according to the NationScape data. Again, Biden still leads on that metric, so it's not enough to give Trump the edge on that. But the gender gap that's emerged has been particularly telling. You saw that happen in 2018, and that definitely helped fuel some of Democrats win in the suburbs, because in 2016, Trump actually won suburban voters, both men and women, by 2 points. I believe it was 47% to 45%. Whereas now he's got 45% of white suburban women, while Biden has 54%.
I want to move on and talk a little bit about the House, because we have really not talked about the House elections at all this cycle. But first,
hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
All right, so we've mentioned the states that are most competitive on the presidential level. What about in the House? This may not necessarily decide who controls the House. We're giving Democrats a 95% chance of maintaining control of that chamber. But this may tell us about how deep Democrats are going into Republican territory, or maybe where Republicans are still competitive despite a difficult national environment.
Yeah, this was a question we looked at recently because, right, to your point, Galen, the House isn't getting as much attention this year because Democrats have such good odds of holding on to their majority. What's interesting, though, is the actual, like, most vulnerable seat is a Democrat. It's Minnesota Representative Colin Peterson of the 7th District there. And that's because that's a district that voted for Trump, leans red, but he has hung on through years now because he's more in the middle, moderate Democrat. But for the first time in a while, he's actually facing really stiff competition from Michelle Fischbach. And so it's a close race. We only give him about a 1 in 4 shot of winning. So he is the underdog there, despite being an incumbent. And then Democrats also have some tough races in the Oklahoma 5th. Kendra Horn, you might remember her from 2018 as a surprise victory, and then TJ Cox in California's 21st district. The big difference here, though, is that Republicans have just a lot more seats that are in question, and that's a combination of retirements, redistricting in North Carolina, and the Democratic-leaning environment. And so even though they need to make up more ground than Democrats to take back control of the chamber, they just have a tougher map ahead of them and more seats that are vulnerable. When we were looking at this earlier this week, they were underdog in 3 Republican-held seats, 50-50 in 9 others, and then less than a 3 in 4 shot of winning in 13 more. And that's just not where you want to be if you're the party looking to take back that chamber.
Yeah, you know, you look at the list of most competitive House races, and one thing that stands out is the role retirements, as Sarah mentioned, have played. On that list are a bunch of open seats, right? The 2nd District in New York, Virginia 5th, Indiana 5, Georgia 7, Texas 24, Colorado 3, right? Like, a big factor here is obviously the Democratic-leaning environment overall, but that environment has also shaped the map in, I think, encouraging, let's say, a lot of Republican incumbents to call it quits early.
Yeah, actually, that maybe gets at a question that I was going to ask, which is that Democrats made gains in pretty Republican territory in 2018. So why are there still so many vulnerable House Republican seats in a national environment that is actually pretty similar to 2018 when you think about the generic ballot polling, or of course, Biden is polling even ahead of the generic ballot Democratic advantage? Is that why simply people are retiring? Are Democrats newly competitive in new territory?
I think it's a combination of, and I think the Indiana 5th District, it's definitely one of the key races that we're watching in the House because it's a suburban district. And there's a real question then of, well, okay, if Democrats win that, they made huge progress in 2018 in suburban areas, but there's still some districts on the table. And what's interesting is that some of the ones in 2018, I mean, Lucy McBath is maybe an exception to this because she's favored to win that in our forecast, but it's more competitive than some of the other races in Virginia that were more moderate Democrats coming into office. And it shows that, right, given the national environment, there are still some suburban districts on the table that Democrats are favored to make further inroads into.
Thinking more big picture about this, what happens to the Republican caucus in the House and perhaps Republican lawmaking, the Republican Party more broadly, if the only members left are people who are representing very Republican areas and perhaps not even that many suburban areas anymore?
I mean, this is like the story of the last 20, 30 years in Congress. It used to be the case that if you looked at every member's ideological score, there was a lot of overlap between the party. But as you've seen primary challengers rise and as you've seen the nationalization of these elections, right? Fewer and fewer voters are splitting tickets. You sort of have these seats where if it's a R plus 15, R plus 10, or even R plus 5, the chances it has a Republican are much higher than it used to be. Same on the Democratic side. So maybe it's not an optimistic thing to say, but if the Republican Party in Congress gets whittled down to only representatives in really, really heavily Republican districts and states, then you're going to see a more ideologically extreme party.
Right. And on that note, too, something important to stress is even if Democrats do, say, win back the Senate this year, because of the rural bias of the Senate, like Republicans will win that chamber again at some point, too. So it doesn't necessarily mean like a shift in strategy from Republicans either, if they're only ruling in more rural areas, because a chamber like the Senate would reward that strategy to some extent.
If Democrats win the House and the Senate and the presidency, what you would expect is Republicans who are left are going to be from disproportionately really red states and districts. They're going to stay incredibly united in opposition to whatever Biden administration does, to whatever Democrats are doing in Congress, and hope that, as has been the case normally throughout American history, there's a backlash in the president's first midterm. So we're kind of seeing this year sort of all the forces that have led to this polarization and sort of policy pendulum.
That's a really good point. Just because the suburbs are leaning blue now doesn't mean that a Democrat trifecta couldn't get more suburbs leaning back red in 2022 or something.
Yeah, I think that also brings up the question of the deeper that Democrats go into traditionally Republican territory and end up then with lawmakers who are going to be fighting elections in that territory in the future, does that have a moderating effect on the Democratic Party and the Democratic caucus overall? Or is partisanship so overwhelming that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are able to whip basically anybody with a D next to their name into voting for whatever the Democratic priorities are?
I think that's a tough question. You know, we think back to 08 when Democrats last controlled all three chambers, right? And Senator Lieberman was the one who famously didn't blow up the ACA, but made it a lot more difficult to pass. I think once parties are in power in terms of passing legislation, that's hard to do. And it's hard to appease all parts of your party, right? And so if you're someone who's in the more progressive wing of the party, you have less incentive perhaps to meet moderates in the middle for what they're trying to push through. I'm not sure. Like, you know, in 2018, that was kind of a big question that we were thinking about because a lot of Democrats' victory were in more moderate suburbs. But I think, at least nationally, it's the squad who's captured attention for the Democrats in Congress versus people from the more moderate districts. And maybe that changes here in 2020 with Biden if he wins. But I could also see it not changing. And maybe that means the suburbs slowly turn back to being more Republican.
It can't help but have a moderating influence overall. I think Sarah pointing to the ACA negotiations after the big Democratic wave in 2008 is a really good example of that, where Democrats had to work very hard to keep their coalition together. That said, I think what we have seen, particularly recently, is that the partisanship is still a really strong force. And so if Democrats enter 2021 with a lot of representatives in really red districts or somewhat red districts, I think I would expect a lot of them to stay with Democrats, stay with Speaker Pelosi on like key votes. And then Pelosi would likely find ways for them to express their independence on other votes. So I think probably the effect is more marginal than it used to be, just in terms of how much of a moderating influence it has. Like, remember, you know, as Sarah was saying, like, Democrats didn't get a public option in the original ACA because of that group of more moderate members. If you kind of spun that all over again today, you'd see a little bit less of that. I think you'd see members more willing to just stay in party line, but there's still some of that.
So let's wrap on the Senate. There are actually Senate races in all of the states we mentioned as the most competitive, except for in Ohio. So there are competitive Senate races in Iowa, Texas, and Georgia, and in fact, two in Georgia. As they are kind of dead heats in the presidential polling, is that also the case on the Senate level? And if not, what are the actual most competitive Senate races at the moment?
Well, so I was looking again at the projected vote share for these states. And what stood out to me is two of the endangered GOP members, so Cory Gardner in Colorado and Martha McSally in Arizona, those increasingly seem to fall pretty squarely in the Democrats column. Challenger Mark Kelly in Arizona, he's favored to win there. And former 2020 Democratic primary runner John Hickenlooper is in the lead in Colorado as well. Maine is a bit closer, but I think what you were talking about the overlap, right, Galen? And, you know, what's interesting to me is Texas isn't on that list, even though Trump maybe only will win it by 3 points or something. So I'm trying to keep an eye on how much does the top of the ticket, because you would expect, right, like in a state like Montana, Bullock maybe won't win, and that's why he's an underdog in our forecast, because Trump will carry Montana. I'm curious, though, what does that mean in a state like North Carolina or in a state like Texas that is really in play in the presidential election?
So to put some of those races in perspective, right now we are forecasting that the final margin in the Senate race in Montana, for example, is about 3 points. In Kansas, we project that it's about 5 points. In Alaska, about 6 points. In Texas, that's a bit bigger. That's about 8 points. But then North Carolina, well, actually, we're showing Cal Cunningham winning by about 3 points in North Carolina. So that seems more in the Democratic column. But then Georgia, we get back to that kind of 50-50 proposition.
Yeah, to your point, you really see kind of the same thing you see at the presidential level. If you look at, okay, what states are the closest, it's really red-leaning states, right? So it's Kansas, Montana, Georgia, Iowa, North Carolina, Maine. With the possible exception of Maine, those are all Republican-leaning states. The fact that those are the closest, I think, speaks to how much trouble Republicans are potentially in.
To wrap up here, I want to play some hypotheticals. So we wake up a day after or 2 weeks after the election, we get the results, and all of those states, let's stick with the presidential ones that we started with, Texas, Georgia, Iowa, Ohio, have gone for Biden. What happened?
Well, I think Biden then really did win the national popular vote by the double digits. You're talking about a huge blue wave election if that's happened.
Yeah, I think in that world, non-college white voters reverted back to the Democrats a bit relative to 2016. College-educated white voters continued their trend towards Democrats or at least stayed at the same level. I think in that world, you'd think that some of these polls showing Trump making huge gains among Hispanics, maybe those proved wrong, and that you kind of saw turnout from the Democratic base, Black women, for example, that really came through in states like Georgia or states in the South, South Carolina. The weird thing is the situation you're describing, Galen, actually isn't far-fetched.
Yeah, we give Biden about a 30% chance in Texas, but only about a 12% chance of Trump winning the actual election. So yeah, the situation we're describing is more likely than Trump actually winning.
Yeah, it's sort of a situation where, like, first of all, the race doesn't tighten down the stretch, which is always possible, but basically the polls underestimated Democrats, which is, as of right now, as far as we know, just as likely as the polls underestimating Republicans.
Right. We've gamed out a number of scenarios in our forecast. And so Biden winning in a landslide, to your point, Galen, is a 35-100 shot, whereas Trump right now only has a 12-100 shot of winning the Electoral College. So yeah, winning Texas seems a lot more doable than Trump winning overall at the moment.
Interesting. But if we do the reverse, so if we say we wake up, you know, a day after, or 2 weeks after, or whatever it is, election day, and Trump has won Texas, Iowa, Georgia, and Ohio, is that like, well, the polls stuck to the end, or is that like a comeback story?
Well, remember, as Micah said at the outset here, Biden doesn't actually need to win those states to win the election. So I think at that point, we already have a sense that the vote's going to be delayed in Pennsylvania and some other Midwestern states. And so we probably won't know who won on election night. But then I think it could have been Biden who won. It could have been Trump who won. It's going to be the margin. And it will probably be a lot smaller of a margin if states like Florida and Arizona are going to Trump, and Trump might actually then win the election. His odds really depend on winning Florida. So if he wins Florida on election night, that's good for him and casts more uncertainty for Biden.
Yeah, I mean, the question is like, what is Biden's margin overall? Right now, national polls have it north of 10 percentage points. I would not be surprised if the race tightens a little bit down the stretch. Like the generic ballot, for example, is more at about 7 or 8 percentage points in Democrats' favor. And in that world where the national margin is, let's say, 7 points, then I think you would expect some of these red-leaning states, Ohio, Iowa, Texas, certainly, maybe even Georgia, would be much more of a stretch for Democrats in that world. they need Biden winning by double digits, I think, to really have a good chance in those states.
All right, well, let's leave things there. Of course, we will be checking back in on these states as we get down to the wire. But thank you, Sarah and Micah.
Thanks, Shaw.
Thank you.
Stay sane.
Yes, likewise. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. Claire Bittigieri-Curtis is on audio editing. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Also, remember to subscribe to us on YouTube, 538, that is. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much up.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.